Chief Judge and the Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. Today, the Flynn Auditorium at Vanderbilt Law School has been transformed into a federal courthouse. We are grateful to Dean Guthrie, Professor Newbern, and the faculty and staff for your thoughtful and careful planning and the arrangements for our visit. We welcome students, faculty, members of the bar, men and women of the armed forces, and the public to this hearing. We shall now proceed to the oral argument in the United States against Durbin. Judge Ryan, who recently lost a close family member, is attending the funeral and will be participating on the record. We shall hear first from counsel for the appellant, then from counsel for the amicus, and then counsel for the government. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges, may it please the court. We're here to address two issues today. One issue is whether the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals erred when it said that there was no prejudice in overturning the military judge's ruling that the act of showing Mrs. Durbin the computer when appellant deleted the images was not protected by the marital communications privilege. The other issue is whether the Mrs. Durbin's statements and her portions of the conversations with appellant were protected by the marital communications privilege, not just the appellant's replies to her questions.
Counsel, before we get to that, why isn't this whole thing waived? She told her family, he told his family, ipso facto.
I would argue that under the five factors that this court have set forth in McCollum to analyze when there was disclosure of the particular statements to assess whether or not this issue was waived. And that is looking at the nature and the circumstances of the disclosure and the statement that actually occurred, the conversation
that occurred. Are you conceding that the record reflects that it was, in fact, disclosed?
It was. In approximately 3 months after the conversation that occurred in March of 2005 between the appellant and his wife, she did tell her sister and her mother in June of 2005. However, at the time of the communications between the two parties, there was never any express or implied authorization to disclose. And unauthorized.
Are you conceding that? Go ahead. Are you conceding that the appellant disclosed the communications to his family?
Appellant has never said or never put forth anything before the trial court that he actually told his parents. The only thing that we have to rely on that he actually had a conversation with his parents is the words of Mrs. Durbin when she said to him, "Did you tell your parents?" And he said, "Yes." We don't know the substance of what he disclosed to his parents. He could have disclosed maybe something along the lines of the fact that he had been looking at adult pornography. We don't necessarily know that he disclosed to his family the contents of the marital communications between his wife and himself.
How important is it that we know specifically what was said to the parents, either her parents or his parents? Do we need to know with any specificity, or is just a general conversation sufficient? This is just an abstract question, not particularly about this case.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's important to know what was said, because if during the course of that conversation with his parents, he did not disclose any of the marital communications between the two of them, then I would argue that the waiver still did not exist because
he
did not disclose.
So he could have said something about the events, but not anything that had been discussed specifically between his wife and himself.
Correct.
And what's the standard?
The standard of review for this.
Not standard of review, but what are the criteria for whether it was disclosed?
Where the waiver is, or for whether there was disclosure.
What's the standard for waiver?
I would have to get back to you on rebuttal as far as standard for waiver.
Okay. Counsel, did the military judge enter any findings as to what the wife told her parents?
He did not enter specific findings as to
far as. If he didn't enter any findings, what would be the basis for us to find a waiver in this case?
I would argue that the basis is that she had an unauthorized disclosure, and so therefore the waiver did not apply. And that would come, again, from McCollum, where unauthorized disclosure does not necessarily mean that an appellant can no longer invoke the privilege in the marital communication
privilege. Did the military judge enter any findings as to what, if anything, the accused told his parents?
He again noted, the military judge noted in his ruling that Mrs. Durbin said that appellant told her that he told his parents, and that was all that was developed on the record. There was nothing specifically developed on the
record.
Did
he enter a finding of fact that the accused, the appellant in this case, did in fact tell his parents? Or did he simply note what the spouse said?
I believe he simply noted just what the spouse said, Your
Thank
Honor.
You.
Even if it doesn't go to waiver, even if it doesn't rise to the level of waiver, can we take this into account, these disclosures into account, in trying to determine whether this was a conversation that was ever meant to be confidential?
This was a conversation meant to be confidential. The appellant in his affidavit that he presented that was attached to the trial defense counsel's motion said that everything that he spoke about with his wife and that conversation with his wife was intended to be private. Mrs. Durbin, in both her testimony during the motion and in the affidavit she provided to the defense counsel, which they also attached to the motion, and that's in the joint appendix, and that's at page 113 and pages 114 of the joint appendix are those two affidavits. And in those, they both said there was never any discussion about whether or not they were going to tell somebody about what they had just spoke about.
Well, which way does that cut?
I would say that cuts to the fact that the intent was to maintain the communications. At the time of the communications, the intent was for it to remain confidential and a
part
of the marriage.
Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell somebody and say it was intended to be confidential. It appears undisputed on the record that she told somebody outside the marital bonds, and so how can it be confidential?
And what I would point to is, again, at the time that the conversation occurred, looking at the five factors that this court set forth in McCollum as to how this conversation was intended to be confidential, the fact that there was this gap of time between the actual conversation itself and the disclosure that Mrs. Durbin made is significant when looking at the nature and the circumstances of the statements themselves.
Well, if you had a similar gap in time and after the gap in time you published it on the Internet, is it still a confidential communication?
And again, at that point, I would still turn back to the unauthorized disclosure is not necessarily preclude the appellant from raising the privilege. Because in the appellant's mind, this was a communication and a conversation that was intended to remain private between
his
wife.
But he told his parents, or at least there's some evidence of record that he told his parents.
And the only
seems to undercut the whole confidentiality rationale.
The only evidence that we have is Mrs. Durbin saying that,
right.
Did you disclose? And the record is not fully developed, Your Honor.
What do you think is your strongest argument, that she revealed her communications, she revealed his communications, she revealed the fact that they communicated? Which is your strongest legal argument? Which is your strongest factual argument?
The strongest legal argument is, again, turning back to the analysis under McCollum about the unauthorized disclosure does not equal waiver.
I'm not talking about waiver. I'm talking about...
I apologize.
603. No, that's all right. Waiver was the theme of the moment. 548 and 603 of the record, as both a matter of law and as a matter of fact, where is your strongest argument in terms of applying 504? You follow that she revealed her communications, that she revealed his communications in some manner, or that she revealed the existence of communications?
The fact that she revealed the existence of the communications.
Well, so it doesn't matter. The privilege is violated if she indicates that we had a conversation?
Not necessarily that they had a conversation, but if the privilege is violated, or she basically steps outside the bounds of that and takes a waiver that she was not necessarily authorized to do when she broke the privilege in telling her family. So if
but
she goes
it
into
the
substance.
But is the issue as to what she testified to at trial?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is not the issue what she testified to at trial?
What she testified at trial is that she disclosed to her parents, but she never goes into specificity, or her sister.
I'm off the waiver issue.
Understand.
What was privileged that she disclosed at trial?
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. What was privileged that she disclosed at trial was the fact that when you take her portion of the conversation where she asked the appellant, well, how did these get here? Did you put these here? What she did not testify to was his reply back to her, and then she was allowed to testify the fact that she told him to get counseling and move out of the house. What happened is, by the disclosure of both sides of, or her side of the conversation, her side of the conversation, it was, should have been protected by the privilege as well.
Well, counsel,
because it was her communications, or because it was revealing of his communications?
Because it revealed the nature of what he was replying back to her. What it allowed the members to do is take a look and draw conclusions on what his communications
Can
were.
Can you evidence that with specific references to the record on pages 548, 549, and 603? Just show us exactly how that happened, if you would.
I'm looking at 77 of the joint appendix, which is page 603 of the record. And then what Mrs. Durbin goes through her testimony is that she said, why do you have these, or what are these, to the appellant. He then does the physical act, which is issue number 2 of the deletion of the images themselves. And then she described how that act took place. And then she goes back, and then further on in her testimony, she discusses the her telling him to get out of the house and to get counseling.
So that it seems to me in this case that we kind of have a different waiver issue than the one we've been talking about. 504 allows the spouse who made the statement to claim the privilege, and also to claim the privilege on behalf of his spouse, unless the spouse waives it. In this case, why didn't her testimony waive that privilege? I mean, what's clearer than testimony in a court as indication that it was waived?
And the application that the military judge took of 504B3 and that the Air Force Court also took of 504B3 is in contradiction to what the federal law and the common law has done. Now, I understand that the common law is not binding, but 504B is firmly rooted, and the premises of 504B is firmly rooted in the common law. And what the federal courts have said, district courts have said, is that, and the circuit courts have said, that both spouses can invoke the privilege. So I think looking at 504B3, when you allow the spouse...
Both spouses can invoke the privilege as to what?
As to the conversation that occurred.
As to the whole ball of wax.
Yes, Your Honor. As far as any marital communications between the spouses.
So we're supposed to disregard the express words of the rule, the military rule, that provides that the privilege can only be exercised by the spouse who makes the communication. It says that the other spouse can then exercise the privilege on behalf of that person unless waived. But the only person who holds the privilege is the person making the communication. So we're supposed to disregard that? Is that the defense position?
I think instead what I would take the approach is that this court examined in U.S. v. Pollard, which is that under statutory, we look at privileges under statutory construction. And while it is the function of the court to apply the plain language of the rule, if that result, and the court's language was, is to be absurd, then we need to take a look at what the end result of the particular application of
the
rule is.
Why would it be absurd?
Well, and again, that's where I turn to how the federal circuit courts have approached this issue. And in looking at what the Ninth Circuit said in Montgomery.
But maybe they wanted a different rule for the military for whatever reason. I mean, the language seems pretty clear.
And the drafter's analysis don't go into, of 504B3, don't go into the effect of eviscerating the privilege. There's a reason that we have the privilege in place to begin with, and that's the sanctity of marriage and the communication within the marriage, and wanting to be able to protect that type of private discussions between a husband and wife.
Couldn't this rule reflect a narrower privilege in the military than there is in civilian life?
it could reflect a narrower privilege, but then that becomes, why have the privilege if the substance of the conversation and the substance of appellant's words are inferred to the members when they get to hear Mrs. Durbin's side of the conversation without hearing
anything else. That's a different point. The point you're making there is that the spouse, in this case the wife, is revealing the communication by the husband, and therefore the husband, he has a privilege because it's his communication that's being revealed through her words. That's different from saying that he, the husband, can exercise a privilege to prevent her from speaking about anything that she says during a marital discussion, even if her remarks do not reveal any confidential statement on his part.
I think wherein lies the issue is that by her disclosing her any statements, it gives the context of the conversation to the members.
But what if you have a conversation in which one spouse comes in, and suppose in this case the wife came into the room, saw the appellant looking at objects on a computer, and made statements to him and challenged him as to his behavior in that regard, and he simply stood mute. Why is she prohibited from testifying in court as to her statements in that regard? Why does he have a privilege to prevent her from testifying in that situation when the rule only gives the privilege to the person who makes the communication?
I think in that scenario, you do have something different. It's a little bit different because there was no statement by that particular individual. I think where the danger lies within what Mrs. Durbin was allowed to testify in this particular case and under these facts is that the appellant told her it was a one-time thing, deleted the images, and then she told him, get counseling, you're sick, I want you out of the house. So it's when you're looking at the entire context of the conversation, that Mrs. Durbin's side of the conversation, that then it slides into where appellant did make that admission to Mrs. Durbin, which the military judge, in fact, excluded.
Thank you, counsel. Unless my colleagues have further questions.
I have one question.
Sure.
Why should we look to the development of privilege law in the Article III courts in this area above all, where we've got rules and the federal rules don't?
And
the federal rules just save common law, you know, because of politics back in the 70s and 80s. But we've got specific rules of privilege in our rules. So why on earth would we look at the Article III courts in the area of privilege above all?
Yes, Your Honor. And it goes to the public perception of this particular trial, and did appellant receive a fair trial when the members were allowed to, while not hearing his words directly, hearing from the context of Mrs. Durbin's conversation, that it basically disclosed his admission to Mrs. Durbin. And
thank
I
you.
Do see that my time is up.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll now hear from counsel for the amicus.
May it please the court. My name is Christopher Hamplines. I'm arguing on behalf of the Vanderbilt Legal Clinic, appearing as amicus curiae in support of Technical Sergeant James Durbin. Military Rule of Evidence 504B gives a person a privilege to prevent another from disclosing any confidential communication made to the person's spouse. In this case, Ms. Durbin's statements disclosed the content of Sergeant Durbin's privileged communications to her.
Can you tell us, using the record, what your best example of that is? Cite to specific lines and indicate what communication of his is being revealed.
Well, I'll refer to the joint appendix, if that's okay. That's what we have. But looking at pages 71 and 72, let's see, where do we start? Starting on line 17 of page 71, Ms. Durbin testified that as they got to the couch, she asked Sergeant Durbin to explain the pictures. And then we know that Sergeant Durbin's statements in response to that request were omitted. And then she testifies on page 72 at line 11 that she asked him to get counseling. that she felt uncomfortable until she knew how they were going to deal with the situation, and that she would like him to leave the house. What we can see from this is she confronted him about child pornography. She asked him to explain it. He gave an explanation or made some statement, and her response to that was that he needed psychological counseling and that she was uncomfortable with him in the house. What the members can infer from that is that whatever he said told them that he had psychological problems and there was some reason to feel uncomfortable. In this context, the logical inference was that he told her the images were his.
So you're on, let's say, on page 540 or page 72, between line 10 and 11, you implicitly infer then that there's a line 10 bis, which says, "I need help."
Not necessarily.
I don't mean that in a silly way. Is that where the implication comes in?
Yes, that is where it is. There is a statement there, and he says not something that tells her that he needs help, yes. So, and in this context, that is probably something to the effect of these images are mine. We know from the record, in fact, that what he said was that it was a one-time thing, and that was at page 27 of the joint appendix. That was.
Let me ask you the same question I asked counsel for the appellant, which is, why in the area of privilege, above all others, should we, you cite a lot of Article III Court of Appeals cases. Why should we be guided by those in the one area of evidentiary law where we've got a set of detailed rules and they don't? They're looking to a whole different standard. So why should we look to that at all?
Well, Your Honor, in United States versus McCollum, this court did look to the federal civilian courts to help give effect to the privilege, to ensure that there is an effective shield of privilege. And in this case, it is a different privilege in the federal context, in the civilian context. But this court can look to it as
persuasive. Do you agree that it's a different standard? Does 504 lay out something different from the privilege as it exists in the Article III courts?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you asking us to look there? I understand your brief saying of just apply 504.
Correct. We just apply Rule 504B.
No, which is it, though? Just be clear. Well, are you asking us to apply common law, or federal common law, or are you asking us, in your theory of the case, simply to apply 504 as it is?
Simply to apply the rule as it is, and the rule prevents disclosure. The reason that we look to the federal civilian cases.
Doesn't the rule, by its terms, seem to only prevent the disclosure of his part of the conversation?
Exactly, Your Honor. And then what we get to is what does it take to disclose his communication? And if we look to, in fact, the waiver context, which you were bringing up earlier, this court has held in United States versus McElhaney and United States versus Smith that statements or testimony that reveal the substance of a communication disclose that communication. In this case, her testimony
did. Well, then do we have a waiver here?
No, Your Honor, because
didn't she disclose that communication to her parents or to her family?
Yes, she did, Your Honor, but under
rule. Well, does that then pull his out of it and waive the whole thing? That's what you seem to be saying.
No, Your Honor, because there wasn't consent there. Rule 510 requires that either he discloses it or he consents to her disclosure. The military judge did not find any evidence of waiver. Or of consent for her to disclose. And as to their discussion about his
who's the privilege belong to? Does it belong to him for his statements and her for hers?
Yes, Your Honor, it belongs to him for his.
He seemed to be implying that he had a veto over hers. Am I misunderstanding you?
To the extent that her statements revealed the content of his communications, yes, he could claim the privilege and prevent that testimony.
If the appellant in this case said in the course of a marital communication, "I've been viewing child pornography on the internet," and she said to him, "It's about time you told me that you've been viewing child pornography on the internet," what privilege does he hold at that point?
Well, that case would be an even more stark example of what we have here. He would, because her statements reveal the content of what he told her, he can claim privilege over her statements.
And if she repeated that conversation to her parents, would that waive his privilege?
Not unless he gave her explicit authorization to do so. Because
may I ask you two questions about your brief?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
On page 6, you say, whereas here a wife's testimony as to her own statements indirectly reveals the content of her husband's response. How does indirectly modify this? Does it, or have the communications been revealed or not?
They have been revealed. The word indirectly modifies it in the sense that there are situations where testimony can reveal the content without repeating the words. That would be direct testimony to, he told me X, versus testimony to the substance of what he told. For instance, in United States versus Smith, this court sort of addresses the difference between direct testimony and testimony to the matter discussed, and says that where the testimony does go to the privileged communication, even if it does not contain any actual portion of that communication, it can still disclose that communication.
And on page 2, you talk about the heightened importance in the military context of marital status. What is that based on? I presume that's in comparison to civilian life?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, it's mostly based on simply the reality that soldiers spend a lot of, will be on tour, for instance, a year at a time, and so they have to be able to communicate with their wife, with their spouses freely. And in that context, it makes it all the more important that they feel free to confide in one another in order to support their relationship.
Is this a legal policy point you're using to supplement your argument, or is this a legal point?
This is a legal policy point that supported the president's providing the privilege in the first place, and that supports the reason that this court in Custis and McCollum has preferred the rule that gives full effect to the privilege rather than a more limited rule, particularly where there's no textual limitation that would tend to frustrate that purpose and that privilege.
Thank you.
So this provides a clear privilege consistent with the purpose of codifying the privileges, because it means that disclosure means the same thing whether judges and lawyers are asking whether a privileged communication has been disclosed such that the privilege has been waived, or whether the communication has been disclosed such that the privilege has been violated. So if we look to the cases where this court has addressed what it means to disclose a communication in the waiver context, we come back to this reveal the substance of the communication standard. And looking under that standard, this does reveal the substance. Her testimony does reveal the substance. And looking to it the same way here provides clarity, because it means that judges and lawyers can perform the same analysis, or at least a very similar analysis to what they already do in analyzing.
Well, why does that provide clarity? I mean, what you're asking us to do is to make an inference that that her response will disclose something that he said without her repeating that statement. It seems to me that that would muddy the water even more. And every time a case came up, they would be arguing that, well, by testifying as to her statements, they are in effect testifying as to what he said, which becomes a very nebulous area.
Well, Your Honor, it would be something that the military judge would have to address on a case-by-case basis in that sense. However, it would be exactly the same as the way they do it in addressing whether or not the privilege has been waived. And also, they already have to be doing that to analyze whether or not the evidence is relevant. Once they establish that the relevance of the testimony, for instance, this testimony, its only relevance to the case was to show what Sergeant Derman had said to his wife. It had no relevance outside of that. So once they already have to do that inquiry to ensure that it is relevant, once they do that, if they find that its relevance is to reveal a privileged communication, that's no more difficult. Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Thank you, Counsel.
I have one question. You're arguing that to take the opposite tack would to be eviscerate the privilege. Isn't what you're arguing for the opposite? Basically, since any disclosure of half of a conversation implies some sort of knowledge of the other half. Doesn't that swallow up the restrictions that the president seemed to see fit to put in 504?
No, Your Honor, because in cases where the other half of the conversation doesn't disclose content, there would be such cases.
I find it hard to conceive of such a conversation.
For instance, in this case, if she asked the same question and omitted response, and she said, well, regardless how they got here, you need to clean the computer because there might be viruses on there, you need to search that. That doesn't tell the members of the court-martial anything about what he told her. So that would be one instance where it would not disclose. So it would not be a blanket rule. It would be narrower than the federal civilian rule.
You may briefly conclude, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Because Ms. Durbin's testimony as to her statements disclosed the content of Sergeant Durbin's privileged communications to her, contrary to his power to prevent their disclosure, we respectfully submit that the decisions below should be reversed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Major Coretta Gray, and along with Colonel Cordova, I represent the United States in this matter. The military judge did not err in ruling that appellant's wife could testify about her statements because her testimony about her own communications, not her husband's, were proper under Military Rule of Evidence 504B3.
Do you agree with the amicus that if, as a factual matter, she in fact revealed his communications, that would be contrary to 504, he would have the privilege to assert over that?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm just making sure whether there's a legal difference of view here or whether it pertains to what occurred.
Right. The circumstance we would imagine is the one in which the military judge discussed, where there is a mirroring of the conversation or a direct quote of what the husband said. In those cases, yes, his communications, he would be able to hold the privilege over his own communications.
Thank you.
Okay, and so what you're arguing here is that this isn't that case.
Exactly, Your Honor.
That whatever was disclosed isn't indicative enough of his side of the conversation as to undercut the privilege?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's
so which Article 3 cases should we not rely on then? Are there any that are inconsistent with that principle?
Well, I think what we have here is that the cases that have been cited by the defense are cases that refer to the wife telling the communications that the husband made, his quote, his words, his mirroring. There are no other cases that are discussing where the wife is talking about her own
statements.
So you're
not asking us then to disregard the Article 3 cases that have been cited?
Not at all, Your Honor. We're saying they don't apply to the facts that we have here before us. The closest case that we have is Van Dyke. It's the Navy Court case where the wife testified about her own statements, those statements were permitted. That was allowed. That goes along with the plain language reading of the rule, as well as the drafter's analysis, as well as Salzburg's treatise that talks about the military rules of evidence.
Now, the military judge, as I read the record, treated this conversation as confidential and restricted the government as to the types of questions that it could ask. Did the government appeal that?
The government did not, Your Honor.
Did the government appeal that ruling to the Court of Criminal Appeals?
It did not, Your Honor.
So why isn't that the law of the case that's before us now, that this is before us a confidential communication?
Your Honor, that is the law of the case before us.
Thank you.
What I would say, though, is that the government certainly recognizes that this court can look at the record and see what happened. We do make reference in our brief that based on the circumstances and the facts we have here and the findings of facts by the military judge where he found that the husband never told his wife not to reveal their communications, where the wife did tell her sister and her mother, where the husband told his wife that he told his family.
And which of those items did the military judge enter findings of fact on?
Well, specifically, the military judge found in the joint appendix, in his ruling on page 116, in paragraph 9, he says, the accused never told his wife not to discuss what he told her with other people. He also refers to the affidavits by the accused and by the wife.
Did he enter any findings of fact that the accused told his parents anything?
No, Your Honor.
And did he enter any findings of fact that she told her parents anything?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And your point is well taken, Your Honor.
Not a point, just questions.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Well, and we would refer you again to our brief, but we do bring that up briefly, but that's not our strongest argument, Your Honor. But Judge Stuckey, you did ask about the
state. What is your strongest argument?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, our strongest argument is that by the plain language reading of the rule, the wife has the privilege over her own statements. In this case, by revealing her own statements, she did not mirror her husband's. She did not directly quote her husband's.
Well, but you seem to be saying something more than plain, because a plain language reading the rule is simply would seem to say that he gets his and she gets hers. But you have earlier in your answers seemed to be saying that he gets his and she gets hers, but if hers reveals his, then he can stop her. What is it?
Oh, no, Your Honor, that's not the case. This is our understanding of the rule, and we talk about it. Actually, I think it's helpful to break it down much as we did in our brief. The first part of the rule talks about who can claim the privilege. Here, it's the person who made the communication. So Ms. Durbin is talking about her own statements. So that's number one. Then the rule goes on to say that the communication may be claimed by the person who made the communication or by the other spouse on his or her behalf. The authority of the latter spouse to do so is presumed in the absence of evidence of a waiver. Well, Judge Urban, that goes to what you were talking about. There is obviously a showing that there is a waiver of the privilege by Ms. Durbin over her own statement. She testified. So she has said, I want to talk about what I said.
So he can't stop.
He cannot stop
to
her.
To the extent there's a core issue in the case, it's the issue of whether she revealed his communications in the amicus view, and I believe in the appellant's view. In paragraph 21, the military judge states, and I'll let you determine whether it's a conclusion of law or finding of fact or merely words, though it says, this court finds that the statements by Ms. Durbin do not sufficiently mirror the accused, such that the accused's right to invoke the confidential communication privilege, blah, blah, blah. So it does not sufficiently mirror. What are we to make of that? So it mirrors, but not sufficiently?
I would disagree. I would not.
So you think the military judge got it wrong or right in that paragraph?
I think the military judge got it wrong. It doesn't mirror at all. There's no mirroring going on here. The statements that Ms. Durbin made was, what are these, or why are they here? There was a little discussion in the whole thing with the computer by the appellant, and then the wife comes back and says, I want you out of the house and you need to get counseling. Now, I would argue, Your Honor, that those could be really rhetorical questions. He didn't have to say anything. She's saying, what are they? She said that she saw the images, she threw up. She first thought, is this my child? Is this our daughter in these disgusting images? Then she said after she got over that and realized that it wasn't, she went upstairs, she confronted him. And so he didn't have to say anything. She's saying, what are these? Why are they here? You need to get help. You need to get counseling. You need to get out of my house.
Now I'm confused again.
Well, why, sir?
What is the government's position? Is the government saying that if it sufficiently mirrors that her statements, over which she holds the privilege and which she can waive, and admittedly did because she testified, are you saying that nonetheless, if those statements sufficiently mirror his, it breaches his privilege, or are you saying not? Are you not?
No, I am saying if her statements sufficiently mirror his, and that he says, I put the child porn on the computer, and she says, why did you put the child porn on the computer? And he says, well, I did it because I had to. Well, why did you have to? That type of thing. Then yes.
So
then,
you would agree with the amicus's brief to the extent it discusses law but not fact.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. That is the government's position. Now, that's not the case here. That's not what happened
That's
here.
That's what I thought you were saying
sure,
earlier, and
sure.
Then I thought you were saying something else, and now we're back to the first. Okay.
So have I gotten you taken care of, Judge Stuckey?
Thank you.
All right. So the sufficiently mirrored, I would say that the military judge even got that part wrong to deal with the facts of this case, Judge Baker.
Well, why are you trying to disassociate yourself from that? I mean, that looks like a finding of fact, and under that finding of fact, you guys win. So, I mean, why are you quarreling with that now?
Oh, well, if you like it, then I have no problem with it, Judge. But my issue is this.
You didn't appeal it.
We did not.
I don't think you're, well, you may be. Are you making the argument that it's clearly erroneous?
Well, I think the issue is this. I think the government will acknowledge that where the wife is basically parroting her husband, that those are his words and that he has the privilege over those words. That's just not the case.
And where a military judge says and recognizes that rule but says in this case it just doesn't do that, it doesn't go far enough, what's wrong with that?
Oh, you're right. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. This is not the case where there was a sufficient mirror.
You may disagree as to degree, but you don't take complete issue with this.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
Does the government agree with the CCA's analysis as to whether the privilege covers the acts involved in this case?
We do not, Your Honor.
What did the CCA get wrong?
Well, in terms of the computer and him turning it around and showing that he deleted, Your Honor, is that what you're speaking of?
You tell me what they got wrong.
I think it certainly can be argued that it's a close case because you could really argue just about any behavior or actions between spouses is some sort of communication. Just about anything could be interpreted as communication.
Is the issue of whether this is a communication that could be subject to privilege before us?
It is not. It is not, Your Honor.
I still want you to answer my question because we're here to shape the law, and I want to know what you agree with or don't agree with in the CCA's analysis.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. Well, what we would say is that in this case, the facts are that he goes to the computer, he moves his hands over the keyboard, he turns it around to show her and says, I deleted it. Now, the Air Force Court says that that was an act of communication and that the military judge got it wrong when he allowed that in over the husband asserting his privilege over that. Again, I think the government's point is, and where do we draw the line? Just about anything that happens between spouses.
Well, that's a slippery slope, but is the government of the view that this is a correct or incorrect statement of the law? Although the acts of one spouse generally do not constitute confidential communications with the other, they do constitute confidential communications when they are intended to convey a private message to the spouse. Is that an accurate statement of the law or not?
That is an accurate statement of the law.
Okay.
We're arguing about the facts here, about the application.
You've answered my question.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
So what's not a communication about I deleted it?
Well, not so much the I deleted it. It's the act of turning the computer around to show her the computer that the images are no longer on the screen.
Well, the phrase is nonsensical in the context of this case without the description of the act to which it refers. That is, how can anyone understand what those words mean without the act? Isn't the act and the words itself the communication that one spouse is making to another?
I think
if he simply said out of the blue, I deleted it, what would that mean?
Well, I would say that we don't take issue with the words, his exercise of his privilege over the words. It's the act of turning the computer to show her that the CCA also said was a communication.
Show her. Wasn't he showing her something that he wanted to communicate to her about their relationship?
Isn't that
those
demonstrative
pictures are no longer there?
It's a demonstrative act, but really just turning the computer to let her see the computer, I mean, it doesn't really say anything without the words.
Well, if it's a demonstrative act, it's demonstrating something. It's communicating something.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly that's the way the Air Force Court saw it, and I acknowledge that issue is not before us today, but we do take issue with it. Just a couple more points that I'd want to be clear about also is, you know, there was the point brought up about the sanctity of marriage and the whole purpose behind this rule, the heightened importance of marital status. And this court has recently made a ruling about adultery being a crime against the family. Certainly here, this wife was concerned about her own children, her children with the appellant in this case. And it's clear that her interest was not in protecting the sanctity of this marriage. She was bringing third parties into it. You need to get counseling. I'm going to tell my parents. You need to tell yours. She was giving him instructions to get out of the house. She had vomited. She told him to get out. This is not a situation where we really are concerned about the purpose behind the rule.
What about Record 53, her testimony? But as you told us the other day, you understood that he was getting that to try that being counseling to try to keep the family together, yes. You understood that it was for his children, and he still wanted to stay together with you. It was a stipulation that in order for us to stay together, that he do seek counseling. Isn't that reflective of some effort to keep the marriage together on her part as well as his?
Well, I understand that he understood from his wife that in order for him to have a family left, he would need to get counseling. This wife, certainly at the time of trial and even at the time that this happened, was no longer interested in pursuing a family situation with the appellant.
At the time of trial?
At the time of trial, but even at the time that she talked to him, she said, you need to get out.
Oh, so, well, there are two different arguments here. At the time of trial, as I understand the rule, is irrelevant. That is, the rule applies to communications made during the confidential communications made during the marriage while the marriage was in existence. The rule specifically understands the marriage may no longer be in existence, but the president has placed such a high value on those communications that the privilege continues no matter what terrible things happen. Is that not what the rule stands for?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so then the second part is you're suggesting that something happened during that communication that made it no longer confidential. So did the military judge and the Court of Criminal Appeals both get it wrong by treating this as a confidential communication?
Well, the government believes so, Your Honor, but we don't have to have that point in order to win on the issue, which is here, her side of the communication, she had the privilege over it, she revealed it, it did not reveal his communication, therefore the government wins. But I just want to put that point out there in terms of, you know, the concern about the whole point of why we're talking about 504 and marital and spousal privileges and communications. It's to protect a family. It's to protect the sanctity of the family. It's to protect the marriage. And here that is not the purpose for which the wife is making these communications.
Doesn't the rule itself have its own exceptions for when the one spouse is engaged in anti-marital acts?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any other exception? That is, if it's not an anti-marital act, if it's not otherwise within the express exceptions, are you saying that we should now no longer apply the purpose of the rule because once the marriage is dissolved, the privilege just doesn't matter anymore?
That's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. I am more just bringing to your attention, if you're concerned, oh my goodness, if we make the ruling for the government in this case, we're somehow eviscerating, you know, the marital privilege. You don't have to worry about that in this case. And I do think it's a well-taken point that if you follow the defense argument, that really there is no purpose of having the rule. I mean, what they're basically arguing is that you cannot reveal anything, no matter the fact that the plain language of the rule gives a privilege to both spouses and comes up with circumstances under which that can be exercised. Exactly, even the final part of that rule is that the spouse, the wife in this case, could be made to testify if it would help her husband. However, she can't be forced to not testify if it would hurt her husband. I don't know if that makes sense, but basically he can bring her.
I'm trying to follow the
document. Sure, sure. So he could bring her in, and let me go back to where the exact reading in the rule is. The part of the rule that says the privilege will not prevent disclosure of the communication at the request of the spouse to whom the communication was made, if that spouse is an accused, regardless of whether the spouse who made the communication objects to its disclosure.
Is that based on the constitutional concept of cases like Davis, which allow accused to have a defense?
I believe so, Your Honor, but I guess what I am pointing out is in this case it simply means that the accused can make his wife reveal communications she made if, as the one who made the communication, she objects to revealing them, he can still make her do it. However, he cannot stop her from hurting his case if she wants to reveal her communications over his objection. That's the plain language reading of that rule. And so, you know, that's a situation. What we have here is a situation where the wife exercised her privilege over her words. She was properly within her rights doing
it. Are you suggesting that we... that in order to figure out the boundaries of the privilege, we need to look at the bona fides of each individual marriage? You seem to be saying that. Or is what you're saying that because this marriage was on the rocks, therefore, it couldn't have been confidential? Or what exactly are you saying?
Well, I'm saying in this case, it was not confidential in the government's opinion because the wife already indicated she told her sister, she told her mother.
Okay, well, that's another point.
Sure, yeah. And she told him to tell someone and get counseling. Yeah. And then he comes back and says, I told my family.
Okay, that's a different point.
That's a different point. Agreed.
But are we supposed to look at this thing on an individualized basis, or does it matter? You know, we said in Custer that we are not going to import implied privileges into this area. You know, the rule is the rule, and we're not going to import, however accepted they are by the Article III courts, we're not going to imply them. It's up to the president.
That's right.
Isn't that what you're asking us to do here?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I mean, what we're saying is if the defense doesn't like the rule, if the folks have a heartburn about how this rule works, there is a method to change the rule. It's just not through this case. I mean, you go to Congress. There is a method to do that. But the rule makes sense. It actually was very helpful about what the amicus brief showed is that there are similar rules in other states and jurisdictions, and the rule works. I mean, here, his privileged communications were kept out. Her communications were brought in. She didn't reveal what he said. She only revealed what she said. And we protected the sanctity of the marriage, which already had problems at the time that these communications were being made. Okay. Just briefly, I actually see that my time has expired. We certainly briefed issue 2.
You can take the time to sum up and conclude your remarks.
Thank you, Your Honor. In conclusion, the military judge did not err in ruling that appellant's wife could testify about her statements because her testimony about her own communications, not her husband's, were proper under 504B3. Additionally, the Air Force Court did not err when it found that there was no substantial influence over the findings from the military judge admitting the appellant's wife's testimony about his act of showing his wife that he had deleted pictures from the computer because the government's case was much stronger than the defense case and appellant would reasonably have been convicted even without this piece of evidence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Will you address the prejudice argument as to the admission of this, but the erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what I was hoping to do with the court's permission, is address issue 2.
And particularly address the, I think it's the third prong, the strength of the defense case.
The strength of the defense case. In this particular case, what the defense did in its cross-examination of the expert in the forensic analysis, and then also somewhat through the stipulations of expected testimony, which I apologize are not in the joint appendix but are found in appellate exhibits, and I will have to look up the numbers for you, Your Honor. But what they did do is show that, one, other people had access to this computer.
Well, no, I thought those people testified that they did not access anything. And with that testimony, where did that leave your client?
The point that I would make with that is it would be against their self-interest to come forward and admit that they were looking at this. They were teenagers, and so it would create and put them in a precarious position if they
were
to come forward
and
admit that.
How many of them were males?
I believe there was two that had two teenage males.
Two out of the eight?
And the others were teenage females and then adult females.
And the males were what age?
I believe one was 14, Your Honor, 14 or 15, but he was in his mid-teens.
And you cited also to the forensic experts, your cross-examination, this issue over whether they were on the hard drive, internal or external, et cetera, et cetera?
Correct, Your Honor. And part of the
doesn't
images
that pertain to 26 of the pictures and not all of them?
It pertained to he found 14 images on one hard drive and 14 images on a second hard drive. And on one of the hard drives, which he testified is hard drive 1A, and this is on page 670 of the record, he said that he found 6 of the images in the logical level of the computer, which is what the user actually uses throughout. But the other 8 images basically resided in the physical level, or what some others call unallocated space, which means the computer user is not necessarily going to see them, that the images were deleted. He also spoke about some of the dates that the images were put on the computer. We're talking October 2002. So there was a significant gap in time. We don't know who had access to the laptop, who could have logged in under the particular username that was associated to some of the web searches. He also spoke about the fact that some of these files were accessed while the appellant no longer had access to the computer, particularly after his deployment, and that was in August of 2005 and July of 2005.
The files being the child pornography pictures?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is his testimony concerning that is on page 704 of the record, where he spoke about that.
So if you had three arguments you hope we consider when we're in conference, what are they in summary form?
Basically, what I would also like this court to take a look at is the materiality of the evidence that was admitted in error, that the lower court held in error, and the fact that without the direct evidence from Mrs. Durbin, which was the only direct evidence that the government had in the case, this case was a circumstantial case to begin with. So that undercuts the government's argument as to the strength of their case without that particular piece of the evidence. So I'm looking at the materiality and the quality of the evidence that is in question here with the lower court's ruling.
But certainly circumstantial cases can be strong.
They can be strong, Your Honor, but without this, and as trial counsel referred to it in the closing argument, the proverbial nail in the coffin of reasonable doubt with this particular testimony from Mrs. Durbin, I think that lends credence to how the government reviewed this particular evidence at trial and how it was a crucial aspect of the government's case that they presented to the members. Because what this evidence allowed is basically a demonstration almost of consciousness of guilt on the part of the appellant when he deleted the images and showed the images to Mrs. showed that he deleted the images to Mrs. Durbin.
What do we do about the lack of a 402, 403 analysis by the military judge?
That is a problem that we don't have any analysis by the military judge under 402, 403. But the argument I would make is under 401, 402, 403, particularly one aspect of Mrs. Durbin's testimony was irrelevant, and that was the piece of her testimony where she said, I want you to get counseling, I want you to move out of the house, because of the fact that without her testimony tied about the action of showing the computer, that piece of the testimony is no longer relevant. It wouldn't have been relevant to anything that the government was trying to put on because it doesn't make any fact more probable. Her comment about, I want you to get counseling and I want you to move out of the house. When you subtract that particular action of the showing of the computer. So while it's problematic that we don't have 402, 403 analysis by the military judge, the argument is to be made that testimony was irrelevant without her testimony about the action. And so that's where the prejudice to appellant was, because when the entire picture of that was painted to the members, it was strong evidence for them to convict.
Counsel, your time has expired. If you have a very brief closing comment, you can do that now.
We would just ask for this court to uphold the lower court's decision in finding that the communicative act of showing the computer and that their appellant suffered prejudice before the members, and that the communication from Mrs. Durbin was intended to be protected under 504B, and the military judge and lower court erred in finding that the marital communication privilege did not apply. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you may sit down. The argument during rebuttal focused on an aspect of prejudice that was not part of the main argument. Counsel for the government, we are prepared to rely on your brief, but if you had any brief argument you wanted to make on that, otherwise we'll simply rely on your brief.
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. That then concludes the argument. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today and for the amicus for the brief and the argument presented. The case is now submitted, and the clerk will adjourn the court.